And I think democracy is the most revolutionary thing in the world.
It used to be. Maybe it will be again. In 2018. That'd be nice.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM, People Powered Radio in LA. Up in Oregon on 91.7 KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, snowy Lancaster, Pennsylvania, I think. 92.9 WLRI in Maui, Hawaii, sunny Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1. In Palenville, New York on 102.9 WLPP. In Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR. Down in New Orleans on 102.3 WHIV. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Detour Talk, and Radio Sputnik, amongst other fine affiliates, both terrestrial and internet. Blanketing Planet Earth, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com here at year's end. Yes, we are still plugging away for you between the holidays, me and really mostly Desi Doyen.
Toiling away in the radio mines.
Someone's got to. We will, speaking of Desi Doyen toiling away, we will have our final Green News Report of the year.
Yes.
Coming up.
It's fun. You'll like
it. Is it?
Yes.
Is it really?
Yes.
Okay. Rounding up the good, the bad, and the ugly, I suppose, from 2017. With a hopeful eye towards 2018.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that would be fair to say.
All right. Maybe that also summarizes what we've got coming up for you on today's show. And as it happens, it is actually our last show for 2017, though Angie Coiro will be in for us on the next thrilling Bradcast. But it seems only appropriate as we finish our last show of 2017, that there's one last battle over democracy, over elections.
A parting gift from 2017.
We'll call it that, yeah. And in this case, it did not turn out well, at least so far, for the Republican. It does not look like it's going to get any better for this Republican. As a Democratic senator from the great state of Alabama now officially is headed to Washington, D.C. to be certified as the next senator from the great state of Alabama after the beginning of the year. Alabama officials on Thursday, according to the New York Times, unhesitatingly pushed aside a legal challenge from Roy Moore and certified Doug Jones as the winner of the December 12 U.S. Senate special election in the great state of Alabama. The action during a brief meeting at the state capitol was essentially the state's final step before the seating of the first Democrat elected to the Senate from Alabama in a quarter century. It was also a swift rejection by some of the state's most powerful Republicans of Roy Moore's complaint that he was the victim of systemic voter fraud. Jones's margin of victory was officially 21,924 votes with more than 1.3 million ballots cast. It was the first Democratic Senate victory in a quarter century in Alabama. And the certification on Thursday leaves Moore, 70 years old, a former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, whose campaign faltered, particularly because of allegations of sexual misconduct against teenage girls, leaves him with almost no avenues to derail Doug Jones's ascension to the U.S. Senate, where the Alabama Secretary of State says that Jones will be sworn in to the U.S. Senate on January 3rd, and that will narrow the Republican advantage in the U.S. Senate to just 51-49. Jones takes over the seat previously held by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. His term will expire in January of 2021. But the election aftermath followed a familiar pattern for Roy Moore, who in the past has been eager to declare victories and pronounce grievances, but loath to concede defeats, as he has not done here. To this day, Republicans note that Moore has still not conceded his losses in the 2006 or 2010 Republican primaries for governor. And there is already speculation in Montgomery, according to the Times, that Moore may run himself for governor yet again or attorney general in 2018. But in a lawsuit filed in state court late Wednesday night at 10:33 p.m., the day before the final certification on Thursday, Moore, who denied the allegations of sexual impropriety, complained that pervasive fraud, specifically voter fraud, had tainted the December 12 special election, and that the Alabama authorities had inadequately investigated potential voter misconduct. Moore found himself aligned against Democrats and Republicans alike on this issue, as well as on the election itself. Secretary of State John Merrill, a Republican who voted for Moore, said he had found no evidence whatsoever of endemic fraud as charged by Moore's lawsuit, and Merrill refused to postpone certification proceedings on Thursday. Judge Johnny Hardwick of Montgomery County Circuit Court, citing a lack of jurisdiction for that court, dismissed Moore's complaints just minutes before the vote was actually certified. That lack of jurisdiction refers to the fact that Alabama law essentially does not allow a candidate, any candidate for federal office, to file a contest in the state. Any such contest would need to be heard by the U.S. Senate or the House in the case of a federal race for the House of Representatives. That's according to state law. So it's no longer up to the state of Alabama. It's no longer up to the voters. It's now up to, in this case, the U.S. Senate, if Roy Moore wants to challenge the seating of Doug Jones there. That seems unlikely in any event, because Republicans that run this U.S. Senate would be unlikely, disinclined, let's say, to go to bat for Roy Moore, who has mercilessly attacked Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Republican officials. Moore's attorney wrote in this wide-ranging complaint, it's about 80 pages, that he believed there were irregularities during the election, including that voters may have been brought in from other states to vote in the U.S. Senate race. He attached a statement from a poll worker that she had noticed driver's licenses from Georgia and North Carolina as people signed in to vote. The complaint also noted the higher-than-expected turnout in the race, particularly in Jefferson County, which is the state's most populous county, and the one where there is also the highest percentage of African-American turnout. Moore's numbers were suspiciously lower than straight-ticket Republican voting in about 20 different Jefferson County precincts, according to the complaint, which asked for a fraud investigation and eventually a new election. Moore said in a statement on Wednesday accompanying this late-night complaint, quote, "This is not a Republican or Democrat issue, as election integrity should matter to everyone." Well, that's true. It should matter to everyone. Though I must say that's somewhat rich in a state that already suppresses voters with photo ID voting restrictions that Republicans like Moore have supported for years, even though in-person voter fraud at the polling place is virtually unheard of, much less the epidemic worth suppressing the votes of millions for. Millions who do not have the very strict type of ID that such Republican laws require voters to have in order to cast their vote. Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill said he had found no evidence of voter fraud, but that his office would investigate any complaint that Moore submits. Rick Hassan, the election law expert and professor at the University of California, Irvine, said Moore's complaint did not raise the sort of issues that lead courts to overturn elections. Writing at his election law blog today, Hassan said, quote, "It seems to boil down to, I should have won under the exit poll, and all of this voting by African Americans must show fraud." He said Moore's complaint might just be a way for him to fundraise, throw red meat to his loyal supporters. Moore has sent several fundraising emails to supporters asking for donations to investigate claims of voter fraud. Before the court's dismissal of Moore's case today and the state's official certification of Jones on Wednesday, a spokesman for Roy Moore warned state officials that they might face consequences if they certify Doug Jones as the winner today. On CNN, Moore campaign spokesman Janet Porter warned Republican Governor Kay Ivey and Republican Secretary of State John Merrill that they may be facing consequences from voters in the coming year. Porter said, "Here's the thing that Governor Ivey needs to know. She's up for re-election too, and there are 650,000 people who are watching this very closely, what they do right now. If they certify what has been proven by three independent experts," she says, "that this is fraudulent enough to overturn the entire election, they are going to be held accountable at the voting booth." Porter went on to note that if illegal voters can steal the election from Roy Moore, they could, quote, "steal an election from Ivy or Merrill in the future," as she sought to underscore the importance of investigating the campaign's allegations. Well, speaking of those allegations, our own Ernie Canning, Ernest A. Canning, bradblog.com's long-serving, long-toiling, wildly underpaid legal analyst, has been looking at this lawsuit filed by Moore late on Wednesday night. He is a retired attorney, author, Vietnam vet, and during the presidential campaign, he served as a senior advisor to veterans for Bernie. Ernie Canning, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
How you doing, Brad?
Oh, you know, counting the minutes until we move the clock to 2018 when everything's going to be fantastic again. But until then, Ernie, I know you've been, and we actually wanted to have you on today to talk about something completely different, and we will. But first, I just want to get some thoughts of yours on this lawsuit filed by Roy Moore. I know you've been scrambling to review it. It's 80 pages. It seems like a Hail Mary of an election lawsuit, which maybe that term is appropriate for this far-right religious fundamentalist guy, Roy Moore. But it was filed just before the certification. It's now been rejected by the court, pretty much out of hand. Is there any substance that you find to any of the arguments you were able to see in his complaint?
In short, no. It's a frivolous complaint. But what I found, and I didn't read every line of it, because a lot of it was just, it's one of the worst pieces of legal writing I've ever reviewed. To give you an example of how ridiculous some of the, paragraph 16 of the complaint begins with this sentence: "No candidate won a majority of the votes cast," end of quote. He then proceeds to acknowledge that Doug Jones defeated Moore by less than 22,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
So the two statements are 180 degrees apart.
Well, he's saying a majority versus, plurality, because there were so many write-in votes. Is that where he's coming up with?
No, he just says, he ends up saying that no candidate won a majority. He clearly did win a majority. I guess you could possibly make the argument, but he doesn't say anything about write-in votes. Mm. He just simply says he won by 22,000 votes, or just under the 22,000 votes.
And
so why make the first sentence? The other thing, this thing boiled down to was a hodgepodge of allegations.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, he seems to be arguing that he was smeared by the media, and the proof that he didn't engage in any sexual misconduct is that he arranged for some guy to give him a polygraph.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as a Supreme Court judge, I'm sure he knows that in almost no jurisdiction in the United States that I'm aware of is a polygraph admissible unless both parties agree to it. So it doesn't prove anything, and the polygraphs don't really measure truth. They measure the response of somebody to questions, and if he's got his own person handling it, it's probably meaningless. The other thing that he does is the thing boils down to his saying, well, he notified the Secretary of State that he wanted to investigate voter fraud. He hasn't had time to complete his investigation, and therefore he'd be irreparably harmed if this thing is certified. Mm-hmm. Well, to get a temporary restraining order, you have to show evidence that you will probably prevail on the merits. The court's not going to step in and do that. So even if it hadn't been the jurisdiction, there was no basis for granting a temporary restraining order.
Well,
he
did give he has an affidavit from a poll worker who says that she saw many more out-of-state driver's license IDs than usual from North Carolina and from Georgia, et cetera. Though those voters were allowed to vote anyway, their names were in the poll book.
Give you an example. Yeah. You might have had a student at the University of Alabama who's from North Carolina, mm-hmm. has a North Carolina driver's license, and can lawfully vote where his dorm is. So the fact that he has a mm-hmm. driver's license from another state proves nothing. The other thing is that you know how rare actual voter fraud is. He makes a guess with, I think it was one person that supposedly gave an interview saying, well, they'd come from out of state to do other stuff and vote, and that person was interviewed by the Secretary of State, mm-hmm. and nothing was followed up. Well, you know, you're talking 21,000 votes here. Where in the heck, how many people would have had to come out of state and illegally do it? We know from a study done back in 2014 that during the preceding 14 years, out of 2 billion votes cast in the United States, there were 31 cases of potential in-person voter fraud. That doesn't quite get you there.
No, it doesn't. But I guess, I mean, what this claim is that people came from out of state, I guess that means they would have then registered to vote. That would then explain why they had these out-of-state licenses, that they weren't supposed to vote there. But what occurs to me when I'm looking over this this lawsuit, Ernie, is that's all discoverable. In other words, if there were more than, 20,000-something people who unlawfully were able to register to vote to get their names into the poll books, well, that's public information. Those people, their names and addresses, they could actually go and investigate and find out if, in fact, they were improperly registered to vote, right? I mean, we don't have to guess at this. They could do an investigation and find out, come up with any evidence. And I don't know if there's any evidence in that. Did you come across any evidence in that 80-page complaint showing that, one voter voted who was not supposed to be registered to vote?
I didn't see anywhere where they actually substantiated anything like that. It was all speculation, basically. The other factor he did bring up, mm-hmm. throw in ESNS voting systems, mm-hmm. and he had an affidavit from a gentleman you and I are familiar with that does his own mathematical analysis, mm-hmm. and he seemed to indicate that if there was a discrepancy between the exit polls and the official count, that maybe the machines had erred or something along those lines. In order to really do that, if he had a right, I have a problem. If he had done from day one and they actually had a right to do so and said, I want all the votes hand counted, mm-hmm. you and I would back him in a second, even though mm-hmm. Even pedophiles are entitled to an accurate count. But
alleged pedophiles.
Alleged pedophiles are entitled to an accurate account.
Yeah.
But that's not what's occurring here. It's just speculation. And there's nothing there. I'm not aware of any case in the United States that has overturned on discrepancy between exit polls and the official count alone. It's an indication you ought to look into and probably a reason why we'd be better served if we had hand-counted paper ballots at every precinct. But as a basis for a lawsuit, no, this thing was nonsense.
And this is one of the points that I've been trying to make for years. I made it during the Democratic primary in 2016. And actually, it seems like every election I have to make it. The exit polls and analysis of those exit polls compared to the results may or may not be right. We can't know unless we do a hand count. So at best, they are a red flag, a yellow flag, something to look at. And I don't mind anybody looking and investigating anything, including Roy Moore. You know, if he can show that he actually won this thing, then I'm fine with him going to the U.S. Senate. But, you know, statistics only get you so far. There is the other matter, Ernie, of the electronic digital ballot images that the optical scanner across the state of Alabama, they use hand-marked paper ballots, but those ballots are scanned by those digital scanners made by ES&S that you mentioned. And what they do is they take a photo of the ballot, and then the computer counts what is in those photos, essentially. Now, right before this election, there was a lawsuit. We had the plaintiff on the show, a lawsuit to retain those ballot images that were taken by the scanners so that if there was any question about the ballots, you could go back and look at the ballot images. They won that suit the day before the December 12 election, but then the Republican Secretary of State went to the state Supreme Court and got them to overturn that suit, and so they no longer retained the ballot images, the electronic ballot images. So even if Roy Moore at this point wants to complain that, oh, somehow they swapped the ballots afterwards or something, you know, you could prove that if you were able to go back to the electronic ballot images and see what was scanned originally. But the Republican Secretary of State did away with that. So, you know, and this is something that Republicans do a lot. They make it very difficult for the public to oversee the ballot. So I would argue here that Roy Moore has nothing but his own party to complain about if he would like to see how those ballots were originally cast, as he suggested in his lawsuit.
The interesting thing with respect to the ballot scanning lawsuit is that Roy Moore's former colleagues, most of them Republican, as I understand it, on the Alabama Supreme Court, had stayed the ruling in that case so that they would not have to retain the ballot images without, in an ex-party fashion, without the successful plaintiffs even being given time to file a written response to the allegations that were made by the Secretary of State. And so that, you know, there was a due process issue involved in that. But if anything, it's Roy Moore's fellow Republicans and his former colleagues on the Alabama Supreme Court that left them in a situation where there were not those ballot scanning images available.
And we got to get to a break here, Ernie, but he's claiming in this lawsuit that he lost just enough votes, apparently, through fraud, about 13,000 votes, that if those votes were flipped to him instead of to the Democrat, that he'd either win the race or he'd be close enough to qualify for an automatic recount, which is only allowed in the state of Alabama under state law with a half a percentage margin. This case, this was a 1.5% margin reportedly. That gives the candidate no ability to even ask for and pay for their own recount. Now, in Alabama, they recount by machine, which is crazy. But either way, shouldn't a candidate like Roy Moore or his supporters, if they want to pay for a recount, be it by hand or by machine, shouldn't they be entitled to that? Right now, it appears there is no venue for a candidate in a federal election in the state of Alabama to challenge an election in any way.
Yes, that's an unfortunate aspect of Alabama law, in my opinion. But the problem that I have is, quite frankly, that recounts are meaningless feeding through the machine. As you know, we really should have, you remember Jill Stein tried to get the hand count in Wisconsin during last year's presidential election and never got it. And there are major issues now as to whether a hand count would have altered the result in that state during last year's presidential election. So, yeah, by all means, every candidate should be able to have, and in fact, the recounts would not be all that much needed if we applied democracy's gold standard and hand counted the paper ballots publicly and posted the results at every precinct on election night.
Well, there's an idea, because, you know, I hear from Democrats and Republicans alike, well, if there's paper ballots, then we can always go back and check them if there's any question about the elections. Well, Jill Stein was not able to go back and check them after the shocking 2016 election. Roy Moore is being blocked from going back and checking them here. So, yeah, the gold standard of democracy, count hand-counted, hand-marked paper ballots on election night before the ballots move anywhere. Ernie, sit tight. I'm going to take a quick break here and come back to discuss what we had originally hoped to talk to you about on today's show. Revolution, the democratic, small d democratic, but also large d democratic revolution that may take place at the ballot box in 2018. Stand by, Ernie. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. You want a revolution? Well, we got 2018 coming up. We could have a revolution at the ballot box, says my guest today, Ernie Canning. He is a California attorney, bradblog.com legal analyst for a very long time. He's a former Vets for Bernie senior advisor. And here at year's end, we are all looking forward to 2018. And with that in mind, I want to talk to you, Ernie, about two pieces that you recently published at bradblog.com. I think they work together and they're all in a similar vein here. First, let me focus on the U.S. House races in California, where you are. Argue, and this is true for California, but it could be really true for everywhere across the country. You argue that Republicans could become extinct after the 2018 elections out here in deep blue California. Let me read from your opening. This was earlier in December. You wrote, a month ago, the notion that every one of California's 14 congressional Republicans could be voted out of office in 2018 would have been dismissed as little more than a utopian dream for the Democratic Party. If we've learned anything, however, from November's tidal wave off-year elections, which saw a diverse group of Democrats defeating Republicans in deep red districts in Virginia and elsewhere, including in Alabama, where Democrat Doug Jones defeated Roy Moore for the U.S. Senate for the first time a Democrat has been elected to the Senate in Alabama in more than two decades. If we learned anything from that, it's that no Republican seat should be considered an absolute lock in 2018. You're right, there are a multitude of factors, some unique to California, that suggest no Golden State Republican, not even House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who trounced his 2016 Democratic opponent by nearly 40 points, that not even he should take his seat in the state's 53-member U.S. House delegation for granted. Really? You think there's a possibility, Ernie Canning, that all of the GOP House members in the state of California could be voted out of office in 2018?
There's a possibility. I mean, certainly for Kevin McCarthy and a few others, everything would have to click into place. But the fact is that what has been occurring, and it ties into my other piece later, but mm-hmm. what's been occurring is not just this Democratic wave, but the extent to which the 2016 election and what has occurred now that they have full control of the government is that Republicans have abandoned all pretense for representing the middle class, and that the policies that they're pursuing are so, you know, not just a matter of oligarchy, but kleptocracy. They're so far removed from the interests of the American people, and particularly here in California, that it is possible for every Republican to lose in California. And one of the points that I make is that I wrote that piece, as mm-hmm. you recall, before the tax bill was finalized. Mm-hmm. But it was very clear from that bill that Californians, whether you're registered as a California Republican or a California Democrat, if you're middle class in California, you're going to get hurt by that tax bill.
Yep.
That benefits primarily the 1% and corporations and nobody else.
And takes away tax deductions for state and local taxes, which is going to hurt folks in California and New York, New Jersey, but certainly out here in California, where you've got very high state and local taxes, that they won't be able to write them off anymore, at least above $10,000. And in a lot of these Republican enclaves, even in this so-called deep blue state of California, you know, property values are high, and a lot of these Republican voters are going to be losing some pretty big tax deductions, it seems like, in 2018.
Well, in fact, there was a LA Times piece where they're quoting some of the Republicans out of out of Orange County, or the, what's at used to be the Republican stronghold in California, that are quite incensed over this tax bill. So. Yeah, there's a number of policies that they are pursuing that go against everything that Republicans have claimed to be in return, terms of fiscal responsibility, and a number of issues. For example, you know, when Trump ran, he had the sense to run with the idea that he knew that he couldn't come out and attack Social Security, Medicare, because even 57% of Republicans are against cutting back on Medicare, mm-hmm. and Social Security is even far more popular than that.
Right.
And so I think it's 71% of voters nationwide are opposed to cuts to Social Security. So he made that promise, and now it's become clear from several Republicans, including Paul Ryan, that this massive deficit they've created, with the that the purpose behind that deficit of $1.5 trillion mm-hmm. is so that they can go after what they euphemistically refer to as entitlements, which is really Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And if they attack Medicare, they're attacking pretty much the you know, it's seniors that seem to be the ones that have been voting Republican. So, yeah, they could be in serious trouble. I don't. There are other factors in other states. Mm-hmm. California, we've been losing. We've been hemorrhaging registered Republicans have been going down for years, even before this. The last time a Republican won a statewide office in California was in 2006, and they've been dropping. Let's see, they dropped half a million voters between 2012 and 2016, and I suspect the numbers are going to go down further. While Democrats have increased, and the largest segment of voters in California, the growth right now is there was about a half million voters between 2012 and 2016 became no party preference. So, it's all moving away from Republicans in California.
And it is true that there are 14 California congressional Republicans. 13 of them voted yes on the final version of this tax bill. I think Daryl Issa may have been the only one who didn't vote against it or who didn't vote in favor of it, if I'm recalling correctly. But, you know, when you put that in there, when you take note, as you do in your piece, for example, there was this one election also in November where you had a 26-year-old lesbian Democrat by the name of Allison Eichley Freeman, who defeated an incumbent Republican state senator, longtime Republican state senator, in the deepest of deep red Oklahoma, a district that Trump had carried by nearly 40% in 2016. When you're seeing that, that's just one example. And all of these elections, really, going back to over the past, over 2017, we've seen pretty much about a 20-point shift towards the Democrats from where they were in 2016. So if you're seeing that sort of a shift in, you know, Republican strongholds like Oklahoma and North Carolina and Alabama, then, yeah, you got to think these Republicans in the state of California need to be pretty concerned about what is about to happen here in 2018. So on that note, your year-end piece here, Ernie Canning, Revolutionary Strategies to End GOP Rule in 2018. I want to talk about that. And you had specifically asked Well, let me read a portion of it, play this audio, and then get your thoughts here. You write, political transformation cannot be accomplished by sitting back and waiting for the GOP to self-destruct, as hard as they seem to be working toward that goal. Instead, the great masses of the American electorate, whose economic survival has been threatened by the greed of the privileged few, must coalesce into an active and overwhelming political force prepared to make 2018 the year of democracy's revenge. And on that note, Ernie, Tony Benn, the former member of parliament, had this great comment that you've cited before in Michael Moore's Sicko. Let me play a portion of that because I think it underscores your point.
I think democracy is the most revolutionary thing in the world, far more revolutionary than socialist ideas or anybody else's idea, because if you have power, you use it to meet the needs of you and your community. And this idea of choice, which Capital talks about all the time, you've got to have a choice. Choice depends on the freedom to choose. And if you're shackled with debt, you don't have a freedom to choose.
It seems like it benefits the system if the average working person is shackled with debt.
And people in debt become hopeless, and hopeless people don't vote. See, they will say everyone should vote, but I think if the poor in Britain or the United States turned out and voted for people who represented their interests, it would be a real democratic revolution.
A real democratic revolution. Ernie, your use of the word revolutionary and political revolution, I suspect, is no accident. You were a supporter of Bernie Sanders, an advisor to Vets for Bernie during the 2016 primaries. So without Sanders on the ballot in 2018, what does this revolution you seek actually entail?
Well, actually, if you even think back to what Bernie was saying during that campaign, it's that he alone and no individual alone is a president. Democracy is not a top-down type. You don't look for a savior to come in and do things for you. It really is not a spectator sport. And the critical thing here, what makes everybody was depressed going out of the 2016 election. You know, what a disaster, we're getting Donald Trump and, you know, Republicans controlling both houses. But there is a silver lining in all that. And that is that the Republicans have now exposed the true nature of their agenda, which is oligarchy and kleptocracy. And it's important because the Republicans operate under, you know, this tremendous advantage of the right-wing billionaire-funded noise machine. Mm-hmm. But what happens is that propaganda, like I understand that David and Charles Koch plan to an extensive propaganda campaign that they're going to be funding to try and teach people that the night is actually day, that giving these massive tax breaks to the billionaire class, you know, Charles and David need tax breaks like the ocean needs more water. But they're going to try and convince the American public that this is good for them. Well, what's happening is people are seeing through the lies, and once an energized public comes to understand that they've been deceived, the entire veneer, the propaganda machine, loses its power. And the interesting thing, I'll tell you a little secret, Brad, money doesn't vote. People do. And you can take the net worth, which is over $100 billion, and Charles and David Koch's access to think tanks and media and politicians, but when they walk into the voting booth, they have no more clout than you and I. They get two votes. The 1%, I think later in that same Michael Moore thing, one of the things that Tony Benn said was that, you know, that the top 1% owned 80% of the world's population. It's remarkable that people put up with it. But they do. They keep their head down and because they're demoralized. Well, what's happening now is, instead of being demoralized, people are becoming energized. You saw it with the start of the one day after the Trump was in office with the Women's March, which I understand was the largest march in the history of this nation, the largest nationwide protest in history. And it didn't stop. It's continued. People are getting effective. And there are certain strategies that can be followed. One is that instead of this idea of only challenging Republicans in so-called swing districts, that we should be challenging from a grassroots, bottom-up, challenging at every level, the school board elections, city council, all the way up through, you know, the federal government, and we should be running in every district. The right wing has understood that for years and has done just the opposite of putting money into trying to target those lower offices, and you get the statewide offices turn around and you get the gerrymandering, and they try and have a self-sustaining situation. What I found really refreshing is that what you're seeing in this is not just depending on a Democratic Party to step forward and have the leadership. It's the opposite of what's happening. For example, in Virginia, the major contributor was one of the power companies there. 13 of the Democratic candidates who didn't get direct support from the Democratic Party, and in part because they were opposing this power company's plan to build natural gas pipelines elsewhere. One of them was a guy named Lee Carter, whose primary support came from the Democratic Socialists of America, and the idea of he was running on the issues of the Sanders Revolution, is that they ended up rejecting this Dominion Energy campaign contributions, and every one of them won and defeated Republicans in districts that had not gone Democrat in years. So you see out of that the potential when everybody's involved. The critical thing is that it isn't just that there's a number of organizations like the Sanders Organization, Our Revolution. I know you interviewed somebody with another organization where they're assisting people in running for office. So I think it was under mm-hmm. a slogan of "Don't just march, run."
Yeah.
But it's also important that everybody else get actively involved too, because not everybody's going to be a candidate. And as I said, democracy is not a spectator sport.
Let me ask you, Ernie, I've got just about 30 seconds here. You write, and I'll point people towards your piece because it's a lengthy, detailed piece about what needs to happen as you see it in 2018 for both the Democratic Party and its voters. But you write at the end of your piece about political maturity and the need at this point for progressives and more establishment Democrats to come together after primaries and support the Democratic candidate, no matter who he or she is. Do I have that right? Because I know that a lot of Bernie supporters might still disagree, I think, at least based on how many of them voted in 2016, refusing to vote for Hillary Clinton after she defeated Sanders in the primary. So what do you mean in this case by political maturity?
Well, it's two-way. One of the political maturities you had, an example of that was when DNC Chair Tom Perez was elected in a very tightly, you know, dispute. He was the establishment candidate mm-hmm. Over Keith Ellison, who was the Bernie supporter.
For the DNC chairmanship, yeah.
Chairmanship. And his first act was, while it's somewhat symbolic, was to appoint Ellison as his co-chair. I understand that, you know, establishment Democrats are going to try and hold on to their position of powers, but at the same time, they need to keep the rules of the game democratic mm-hmm. and even. Eventually, as more progressive candidates win, it's probably this, what we're seeing is an internal fight within the Democratic Party, is going to end up with the progressives are going to ultimately gain control over the party. But the flip side of that is that so they have to be mature enough not to attack Democratic progressive candidates if it comes between that progressive candidate and a Republican. On the flip side of that, I think progressives have to display the same level of political maturity. Yeah, if during the primaries fight all you can to try and move the progressive agenda forward, but you can't sit the election out like many did in 2016, because there really is a major difference between the two parties. And I don't think I have to go any further than what happened with the appointment of Judge Gorsuch to prove that.
To the stolen Supreme Court.
Exactly.
So you seem to be saying prioritize getting Republicans out and then push for Democrats to be more progressive down the road, if I understand that.
Well, I think you can push now for progressives to be, and in California, where we have this top two primary system, I could very well see where we may end up having a Senate race next year, the general election, where the only two remaining are two Democrats. In which case, by all means, the progressives should pile on to the progressive candidate.
Ernie, I got to get out of here. I'm going to point folks towards your piece, Revolutionary Strategies to End GOP Rule in 2018 and California Congressional Republicans and Endangered Species, both at bradblog.com. Ernesto, I got to get out, but I want to thank you for all of your great work at bradblog.com this year. And, well, if we can, we'll be continuing into 2018. So thanks in advance for whatever the hell, for being there for us to greet whatever the hell happens in this coming year. Thank you, my friend.
And Happy New Year to you and Des in advance, too.
Thank you, sir. All right, a quick break, and we are back with the final Green News report of the year, I think, and a little bit more after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away.
Just one voice singing in the darkness. All it takes is one voice singing so they hear what's on your mind. And when you look around, you'll find there's more than one voice.
Yeah.
Singing in the darkness.
There is more than one voice out there singing in the darkness. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Many of you have stepped up to answer our call. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to pledge your support into the new year. To help keep us going as we would like to. It is getting very difficult, though, and so my thanks again to those of you who have stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us keep singing, perhaps a sometimes lonely voice out over your public airwaves.
The more voices, the better.
And speaking of lonely voices, Desi Doyen, you have been at the Green News Report for, I think we're going on, what, 9 years or so now?
Yeah.
Does that sound about right?
Yep.
And you have at times been a lonely voice there, but you have always been right, time and time again. As we are reminded, as we review in our latest Green News Report, the good, the bad, and the ugly from 2017 in our latest Green News Report.
Freezing Arctic winds have turned the Great Lakes into massive snow machines.
2017 leaves a parting gift, record snowfall in Pennsylvania. Meanwhile,
they didn't have time to save this home. While they were trying, though, the heat melted some of their hoses.
Southern California's Thomas Fire is now the largest in state history. 2017 to rank among the top three hottest years ever recorded, plus
things take longer to happen than you think they will, but then they happen much faster than you thought they ever could.
Al Gore says the clean energy revolution is unstoppable, no matter what Trump does.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You have two options, basically. You can curl up in a fetal position and fall into despair.
I'll take that one. This is your year-end Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, the fire we've been watching out west here in Southern California is now the largest in state history. And meanwhile, out east, unbelievable snowfall.
Yes. 2017 walloped Erie, Pennsylvania with a parting gift, a record-shattering 60 inches of snow, about half of Erie's average yearly snowfall dumped in just 2 days, breaking the state snowfall record. Now, the exact influence of climate change on this specific storm will take time to determine, but it is in line with climate science predictions that, yes, global warming will generate greater snowfall totals in certain types of storms.
5 feet of snow?
5 feet in 2 days.
Yes. It's climate change.
In Southern California, as you mentioned, the Thomas Fire in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties has now grown to be the largest wildfire in state history. And that's even more remarkable because it is a winter wildfire during what is supposed to be California's rainy season. but there hasn't been any rain. Meanwhile, both NASA and NOAA predict that 2017 will likely clock in as either the second or third warmest year ever recorded after 2015 and 2016, and that is also stunning in a year without an El Nino to boost global temperatures.
And a year without a Santa Claus.
2017 has been a record year of extreme weather events in the United States, including a record 3 Category 4 and 5 hurricanes wreaking destruction, plus record wildfires in Montana and California. But here's the good news.
Well, take your time.
As Joe Rome over at climateprogress.org says, quote, 2017 showed that the global clean energy revolution is unstoppable. The price of solar energy continues to plummet. In 2017, the price of solar fell 26% over last year alone. Wind energy prices have dropped 24% from last year. And in many areas, wind and solar energy are the cheapest sources of energy without government subsidies. Battery storage in 2017 moved into market position. Battery prices have dropped 75% since 2010 alone, and ranges for electric cars have doubled this year. Tesla unveiled an all-electric semi-truck with a 500-mile range, and Tesla's battery farm in South Australia, built in just 3 months, has already prevented blackouts. 2017 also marked the beginning of the end of the internal combustion engine. Some of the largest economies in the world announced they are phasing out cars that run on fossil fuels, and they will shift to all-electric and hybrid cars. India, France, the United Kingdom, and the world's largest car market, China.
And pretty much all of the major car manufacturers have now said they are moving to electric.
Yes, they announced they are electrifying their lineups all within the next 10 years.
And remember, they used to laugh at Al Gore when he said, "We will be doing away with the internal combustion engine."
Toyota's not laughing. They just announced in December they will offer an electric or hybrid version of all of their models by 2025. Of course, progress in clean energy is not enough to halt climate change without aggressive government policies, which seems unlikely with the Trump administration.
You think?
But speaking of Al Gore, in a recent interview on the broadcast with guest host Angie Coiro, former Vice President Al Gore offered a call to action.
You have two options, basically. You can curl up in a fetal position and fall into despair, or you can work on expanding the limits of what is politically feasible. It's a race. The problem's getting worse, faster than we feared, but the solutions are developing faster than we hoped, and they're gaining momentum. The world, I believe, is in the early stages of a sustainability revolution that has the magnitude of the industrial revolution, but the speed of the digital revolution.
Let's hope he's right, whether it's in time to save the world, especially with Donald Trump trying to destroy it. That's a whole different question. For much more on all of these reports and the full interview with Al Gore, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. to help the Green News Report continue into 2018. Here's to a happy and peaceful new year, and we'll see you in 2018. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyne.
And this has been your year-end Green News Report.
Right here, right now, watching the world wake up from history.
In theory.
In theory.
In theory. Thank you very much, Desi Doyne. One story that broke too late to get into our GNR. I think this is good news. An appeals court has declined to reconsider its September decision that undid a previous court ruling that had overturned the Obama administration's fracking rule for federal lands. That's a lot of overturning and undoing there.
Yes.
But in short, yeah, you got it.
Yeah. In short, basically, the Obama administration said, "Hey, on public lands, oil and gas industry must stop methane leaks." And then, of course, the Trump administration tried to reverse that. A court said, no, nuh-uh, you still have to put it into place, and it still is going to be implemented even while this is wending its way through the courts.
And it will be put in place as of January 12. However, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, is making their own rules that right. would undo this.
Yeah, they're going to try to redo the Obama-era methane leak rule. And, of course, if and when they actually complete that new rule, that will also go into court because they have to show a substantial reason scientifically with data and evidence and stuff to be able to repeal that and put in a new one. So this will still be in court. But good news, in the meantime, it must be implemented anyway.
Good news for environmentalists. I mean, a lot of this is moot. Because the BLM is going to change it anyway under Trump. But for now, at least, the previous rule stands. And so when there are future challenges, there is that. So
yes.
there is some good news concerning fracking.
And breathing.
As we finish 2017 and we head into 2018. And let's see. Well, this is our last show for 2017. Angie Coiro will be with us tomorrow. We've punched a lot of folks over this past year, so I think I'll leave the last punch of the year to The Daily Show's Lewis Black and his year ender.
As 2017 draws to a close, I'd just like to say good riddance. I'm not going to say you were the worst year in history because I didn't live through the plague. The point is, I just know that 2018 will be a fantastic year for so many of you, especially if you're climate change, because that just keeps getting hotter and hotter. And gun violence, I know you've got your sights set on the new year. Boy, are we all But in 2018, I hope all your wishes come true, whether they be for health, prosperity, or a quick and painless death. And hey, that's 1 year of Trump's presidency down, and only 3 more years of pants, crap, and terror to go. Whoop-dee-doo. Sleep tight, America.
What he said. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Ernie Canning, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other all year long, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks and the Twitters. I am simply The Brad Blog. And again, my thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. To help us continue to do what we try to do every day over your public airwaves into 2018. That's it. Angie Coiro is in for us tomorrow. We will see you next year. I'm Brad Friedman. Happy New Year and good luck, world.